From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Winston Blackmore won't say how many children he's got, but it's widely believed to be more than 100. He's got 24 or so wives.
Franklin, do you know how many sisters and brothers you have?
Yeah, about 36.
Is there that brainwashing to this degree? Do you have pity on these women?
Polygamy, an outlaw sect of Mormons, possibly abused children at the Yearning for Zion Ranch. It's the kind of story nobody could ignore, especially as the coverage continued for a fourth week. The news from this strange corner of hidden-in-plain-sight America continues to take surprising twists, not least when the fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints began to mount a modern online PR campaign in their own defense, in which the key pitchmen are the mothers, those women in their Little House on the Prairie costumes, perhaps innocents, perhaps victims, perhaps criminals in their complicity, are demanding to nurse their babies and in so doing, striking a chord.
She walked right up to the lady and said, "Please let my mother come." And they would not let her.
As the removal of more than 400 children from their family's custody triggers controversy in Texas and around the world, the very parental relationships in question in the case are being invoked to generate sympathy for the Zion Ranch community. Brooke Adams, and this is a first for OTM, is the polygamy correspondent for the Salt Lake Tribune. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
The FLDS community has been described as something like a tribe in Papua New Guinea that is untouched by the modern world. Are they really living in the middle of the 18th century?
I think that's a false perception of this group. They have a number of people who have been to college. They are quite internet savvy, as the world now knows, with the websites that they've put up to spread their view of what's happened to them in Texas. So I think the idea that they're totally isolated is false.
I want to ask you about the websites that have popped up amid all of the uproar. Are they coming from within the Yearning for Zion compound itself?
Yes and no. The FLDS that are there at the ranch have put up, as far as I know, two websites on which they have posted a number of the pictures they took during the initial days of the raid there at the ranch. But there are a number of other websites that have been put up related to the actions in Texas. One of the most interesting ones to me was a coalition of breastfeeding mothers who put up a website when the judge initially talked about removing the children who were still nursing from their mothers.
Did you get a sense that the story changed a bit, that the narrative changed when the issue of breastfeeding came up and it kind of stopped focusing, at least briefly, on the men in the community and on the women and their physical relationship with the kids?
I did think that it would bring in a different audience, and it did. I was surprised at how quickly people, women out beyond this community who may not have been paying total attention to the issue until that moment, suddenly chimed in. I think that got at a very fundamental belief that there's a close bond between women and their little children, and that this seemed to take what was happening in Texas to a whole new place in making an arbitrary decision to separate certain women from their young children. And then the other point at which I thought we were bringing in a different audience is when somebody here in Utah staged a protest at the Houston Rockets Utah Jazz playoff game. And I just think that showed the broad spectrum of people who were paying attention to it.
There is another issue apart from the welfare of the children that has emerged in all of this, and that is the women in the community who have been occasionally portrayed as essentially being slaves, having to be utterly submissive to the men in the household. And I wonder if in your reporting on this story, you get the sense that the women are utterly powerless within this community.
I don't get that impression, and I'll talk about two women that have spoken publicly about their lifestyle in particular. One of them testified, she talked about how she had gone to college and then had gone on to pursue training as an EMT. And she said she did that even though her husband had not wanted her to become an EMT. So there was an example of some independence and modern thinking and making her own decisions about her lifestyle. Another woman testified about going to college again and being trained in computer design and web design. And again, she decided to pursue her career interests. So I think there's more women like that than we hear about. The problem is we hear so little from this community over the years, and we hear mostly their characterizations put out by critics or people who've left the community. And what you can see when you were there at the ranch is that these women were pretty outspoken about their making a choice to live this way.
All right, Brooke. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Brooke Adams covers polygamy for the Salt Lake Tribune.
It's been 9 months since Rupert Murdoch's News Corp absorbed Dow Jones and its crown jewel, the Wall Street Journal. But it's only been a few months since Murdoch actually took over control of the paper. A very busy few months. We've seen design and layout modifications, a front page increasingly devoted to politics as much or more than finance, and a new weekly sports page. Staff changes, too, including the sudden departure this week of managing editor Marcus Broccoli. Meanwhile, Murdoch's interest in adding the Long Island-based Newsday to holdings that include the New York Post has fueled speculation that he is engaged in a pincer move to corner and conquer the New York Times, and that the changes at the Journal are designed to reposition it as a sexier alternative to the Gray Lady. Jack Schaefer, who writes the Press Box column for Slate, doesn't buy it.
You tell me if a combination of the Wall Street Journal and Newsday would satisfy your news needs the way that the New York Times does. I mean, it is still the superior general read. And I don't see how News Corp can turn the Wall Street Journal into a replacement newspaper for the New York Times anytime soon. One of the places that Murdoch is wisely going after the New York Times is that it's going to start a weekly glossy magazine called WSJ. And that's clearly designed to go after both the readers and the advertisers of the New York Times Magazine, which is a very lucrative part of the New York Times package.
The battling Bancroft family that owned the Wall Street Journal sold it to Murdoch with the understanding that an independent committee would oversee the journalistic integrity of the paper, and this included approving certain hirings and firings. Last week, Murdoch seemed to completely ignore the committee when he received the so-called resignation of managing editor Marcus Broccoli. Can you explain what happened there?
Can we say horse dung on the radio?
Sure.
Because the whole idea of this special committee designed to oversee Murdoch and prevent him from somehow tarnishing this jewel of American journalism was a fig leaf for both Murdoch and for the Bancroft family that didn't want to appear to be selling their newspaper to a vulgarian. Well, it's obvious horse dung. And it was horse dung in the United Kingdom when Murdoch purchased the Times of London, and a special committee was established. And, you know, just as Murdoch forced out Marcus Broccoli from the Wall Street Journal, he forced out Harold Evans and just pushed the committee aside. I think that when you pay $5 billion for a property, you should be allowed to do whatever you want to do with it, include run it into the ground if that's what Rupert Murdoch wants to do.
So why did Murdoch seek the so-called resignation of Marcus Broccoli?
All I know is what I've read in the news reports, and that was he and the new publisher, Robert Thompson, who we brought in from London, wanted to change the journal faster than Broccoli appeared to want to change the journal.
So if there haven't been what amounts to significant changes for you, it does seem as if there are big changes in the offing.
What changes do you think?
Well, I guess I'm still not entirely persuaded that there isn't an effort here to turn the journal into a general interest paper that could rival the Times.
Here's why that doesn't work for me. Right now, if you look at the architecture of the Wall Street Journal, two of the four sections are hard business news, the money and investing section and the marketplace section. Personal Journal and the A section also have business news in them. In your New York Times, you have weekly sections on dining, you have weekly sections on science, weekly sections on travel, reflecting all the interests that a general interest reader would want to have addressed. I don't see how the Wall Street Journal gets to that point and at the same time maintains this fabulous franchise of being the leading business newspaper in the United States. I mean, it is now the largest circulation daily in the United States.
What about Murdoch's influence on the editorial board, an influence he is by rights allowed to have? They're both conservative, and so it would seem that they'd be very much in sync. Do you expect him to exert a lot of influence there?
I think you're making a mistake when you call Rupert Murdoch a conservative. He is a political opportunist. If you take a look and see who he supported in the most recent Australian election, it was not the conservative. It was the liberal. Likewise, in the United Kingdom, Murdoch eventually put all the support of his daily newspapers there behind Tony Blair.
He likes to back a winner.
He likes to back a winner. He likes to have access. He threw a fundraiser for Hillary Clinton's reelection bid for the Senate in 2006. This is a mistake people make all the time about Rupert Murdoch, the idea that he is some sort of conservative ideologue who has come to the United States to, I don't know, guarantee the Reagan restoration, when all he really is a political pragmatist.
You've been pretty critical of Murdoch in your column, but you've also conceded that the guy knows how to run a business. Do you think he's one of the last best hopes for at least the short-term future of American newspapers?
I don't think I would say that. Murdoch is not prone to the whining and woe-is-me-ism that so many other newspaper men practice. He's willing to invest in his properties. He's willing to lose money. For a 77-year-old man, it's almost as if he has begun the first year of a 20-year plan to modernize his media portfolio. So he's a real optimist. Remember when he started the Fox television network? Everybody in the country said, oh, there's only room for three conventional networks. And when he started Fox News Channel, people said, oh, there's really only room for CNN. There can't possibly be room for another. And time and again, he goes in and he defies the so-called experts because he's a force of creative destruction. He will go in and he will steal anybody's bacon. And he generally steals it honestly by competing. And for that, you really have to admire him.
Jack, thanks very much.
It's always a pleasure.
Jack Schaefer is Slate's editor at large, and he writes the Press Box column.
Last month, a new search engine was born. It's not looking to out-Google Google. It's specifically engineered to return results of interest to a particular subset of the population, black people. The site, called Rushmore Drive, after the street where it's headquartered in Charlotte, North Carolina, uses a unique algorithm to find those sites that are most heavily trafficked by blacks and edge them towards the top of the results list. I'm using the word blacks deliberately. This site isn't just for African Americans. It's for the black diaspora, Africans, Caribbeans, and Latin Americans of color living in the United States. Johnny Taylor is the CEO of Black Web Enterprises, the division of IAC Interactive that developed Rushmore Drive. He's here to explain how a search engine can be tailored to a group.
The algorithm is one of the few places where the black community becomes the majority for purposes of producing results. In all of the mainstream search engines, the majority's behavior is what dictates how the results are ultimately delivered.
So you actually kind of rig the game by giving more prominence based on ratings or whatever to certain websites because they are identifiably black?
There's no rigging of the game. We have created the new game. We have finally found a way to deliver something more relevant to a targeted group of people. What the algorithm attempts to do, based upon behavior of this community, is to elevate those results that mean something specifically to the audience. So, for example, typing in the word Whitney at a search engine may yield Whitney Houston and Whitney M. Young, two prominent African-American individuals. And in a mainstream search engine, it may only yield results for Whitney College or Whitney Museum. What we do is deliver all four. So it's not a rigging of anything. It's a new way to crawl the web and deliver a more relevant search experience.
Now, Google is not in the search engine business because they think it's fun. They do it because it drives something like, I don't know, $17 billion worth of revenue in a year. And I assume that the search advertising is the center of your business plan. What kind of advertisers are going to be buying search ads on Rushmore Drive?
Black people buy everything. So it's like every other market. And what's interesting is there's an opportunity here for those advertisers who currently have a significant market share in the black space to advertise. But it's also an opportunity for advertisers who've not yet really reached this audience and is looking for an opportunity. When I'm looking for home appliances, if Lowe's does not have deep penetration in the black space, then maybe it should do so, particularly if Home Depot continues to come on the front page of our search results. And so all types of advertisers should be reaching out. It's really not about excluding or trying to stereotype or play into stereotypes. It's asking people what our algorithm is trying to do is to really understand that when the black community types in a query, what does it really mean? What is it looking for?
Johnny, thank you so much for joining us.
Very much appreciated.
Johnny Taylor is the CEO of Black Web Enterprises. Internet entrepreneur Omar Wasso co-founded BlackPlanet.com in 1999. He agrees that Google is not always in sync with its black users.
It may not be that when people are going to do searches for sort of headline news that Rushmore Drive is going to give a better perspective than Google. But, you know, when you're looking for, you know, take the stories that are dominating the headlines now, Obama and Jeremiah Wright, there's a black perspective on that that's not going to be reflected in the mainstream media.
Have you used Rushmore Drive yourself?
I have played with Rushmore Drive, yeah.
What have you noticed?
What's challenging about it is that it's not obvious to somebody who's using it for the first time how it offers a better search experience for African Americans. And so I think they've got a bit of a marketing problem. And it wasn't until I read an article about the site that I understood how much fairly sophisticated technology is going on behind the scenes.
Let's talk about the larger picture of black media. There seems to be some sort of flourishing process going on, almost as if the digital divide that seemed like such a worry may not be such a worry after all. Is Black America catching up online?
One of my favorite quotes by a science fiction writer is that the future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed. And what we've seen with the internet is that the digital divide was really, I think, more about a moment in time where there was a lag between early adopters and mass America. It's become something that's much more a part of the fabric of everyday America, including black America. Where we do see a divide on the internet, it continues to be around sort of class and education, less so about race.
Because it costs relatively so little to get up and running online, do you expect for that reason alone to be a greater number of choices and a greater ability to reach a black audience?
I think we're already seeing that that's happening online, that there's a much greater variety of black experiences represented on the internet and a much greater variety of black points of view represented on the internet.
That gets to your business, BlackPlanet.com, which is a very broad-brushed affair and I guess attempts to be relevant to the entire breadth of the black community. What about the slicing and dicing of your audience? Are you going to spin off to narrow and narrow niches within black America, or do you think that your business model works fine for the foreseeable future?
Well, I should be clear about one thing, which is that a couple weeks ago, Black Planet was sold to a large urban radio network, Radio One. With their base of radio stations, they've got 53 stations around the country, are going to be able to market to a very broad African-American consumer base that will, you know, undoubtedly both grow the site but also reflect that core mainstream radio audience. My advisor at Harvard, Henry Louis Gates, has a website, theroot.com, and theroot.com is really targeting a much more sort of literate audience that is interested in reading about news and politics. Black Planet is much less about news and politics. And then there's a part of The Root that is genealogy. African Americans are hugely interested in genealogy. And then even Radio One has just launched a news site called news1.com. And so we're seeing lots of different kinds of services. You know, I think no one site can really serve everyone. And so what's great about what you see online that we don't see so much in television and radio, and we see to a lesser degree, though I think still more so in print, is this kind of targeting by African-American media makers of segments within the community.
One final thing. Neither the future of BlackPlanet.com nor RushmoreDrive.com will hinge on whether users will find them interesting. It will hinge on whether advertisers find them interesting and prosper by advertising there. Is what would seem to be a natural market actually materializing in the way that you expected?
Well, let me first just challenge you a little on the premise that the consumer doesn't matter. One of the things that's most exciting about the internet is that if you don't really super serve your customer, there's so much competition online that people will go somewhere else. The other customer, though, is obviously the advertiser. And I think what we've seen broadly in the internet is that the advertisers have been slow to adopt it. And I think the folks targeting ethnic audiences have been even more cautious generally, although there have been some real standouts. And so it took a while for some of the major advertisers to come on board. But I think they're realizing that it has the potential to be one of the most powerful forces in helping them get their message out and are embracing it now.
Omar, thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care.
Omar Wasso co-founded BlackPlanet.com in 1999, just sold it, and he's now getting a PhD in African American Studies at Harvard. Rushmore Drive and Black Planet hope to capitalize on the collective interests of a particular group on the principle of birds of a feather flock together, what social scientists called homophily.
Behaviorists say it's human nature, but Ethan Zuckerman, a fellow at Harvard's Berkman Center for the Internet and Society, observes that homophily is amplified on the net, and that ought to be cause for concern. In an age where TV news offers more and more opinion and less international coverage, the internet would seem to be the logical place to find diverse views, surprising voices, and news we need. But he says we don't find that because we don't know where to look, and mostly because we prefer to flock.
I'm a little worried about homophily because I think homophily has the danger of making us stupid. And I mean that quite literally. I think that in a digital media world where we have the ability to pick and choose whatever it is that we want to look at, we've gone from a supply problem to a demand problem. In the age of broadcast media, where we had four television networks and, you know, most cities had one or two major newspapers, you were trusting that media outlet to give you a wide view of the world, to let you know about stories you might not otherwise find. And there was a really big, strong editorial function there. And one of my questions is, how do we build an internet that doesn't just show us what we want to see, but also does a pretty good job of showing us what we need to see?
So what are the ways that have been devised on the internet to deal with this demand problem, by which you mean getting people to want to demand things that are outside of their comfort zone?
My friend Dana Boyd, who studies internet and sociology, believes that probably the most powerful force on the internet is boredom. The internet briefly made Moldovan pop music enormously successful because there was this wonderful YouTube video of a young man singing along to a Moldovan song called Dragonstun Dinte. And so some number of internet users found out much more about Moldovan pop music than they ever intended to. There's a lot of sites emerging out there that try to help you stumble upon sites that you might not have been looking for but are likely to be interesting to you. One, of course, is called Stumbled Upon. Another is called Dig. Another is called Reddit. What most of these sites work on is a pretty simple principle. The people who are reading the site will suggest links that they think will be interesting to the audience. People will vote them up or down. If they make it to the top, you are likely to see it.
Yes, but as you've written, the users of those sites are usually birds of a feather. It's not going to get us out of our box.
So one possibility is if you feel like you're in a box, it would be to find a different way to find a different flock.
What if we don't know we're in a box?
I think this is a place where there's still a need for editors. Mainstream journalists have a lot of responsibility to a greater extent than ever before to get voices from the developing world and tie them into stories that we pay attention to in this country.
But more than ever before, we have the opportunity to ignore those voices, to never encounter them, to never hear an opinion with which we don't agree or a fact that doesn't stand in accordance with our opinions.
I think we're at a break point. A lot of people realize that there's something broken in the media environment. The problem is we're not yet in a position to pass the baton onto participatory media and the internet because we haven't really thought through these issues yet. Could we build a news portal where 80% of the stuff is pointed to by people like you and 20% pointed to by people very much unlike you? It would be interesting if we could get sort of our different echo chambers to agree to have sort of an exchange program.
Now, how do you try to lure people into paying attention? You wrote that you have a short list of arguments. Actually, you have three appeals: to guilt, to fear, and to greed.
I think greed is probably the strongest of the three. Greed is what I use when I get on stage and talk to venture capitalists. And I say, you know, did you know there's an emerging middle class in Africa and you know nothing about their consumer behavior? If you would only go out and read the blogs of these middle class Africans who are involved in the tech industry, you might learn something about how you would sell a car or a computer or a bottle of beer to this new emerging market. That one at least is somewhat positive. I think the other two are actually a little bit scarier. The fear one essentially says, hey, remember Central Asia? That's where some of those guys who blew up the Twin Towers on 9/11 trained. Shouldn't we continue paying some attention to that? And while that's a very real argument, it sets people looking for information with a very specific tone. I also think guilt is a very dangerous one. I think a lot of people right now are paying attention to the Sudan and Darfur out of residual guilt over Rwanda. And while it's better than not paying any attention at all, it's a very specific, very narrow, very focused form of attention. My hope is that there's another form of attention, which I refer to as xenophilia. Basically, this idea that what's most fascinating and what's most exciting out there is the diversity of the world, the diversity of perspectives.
It's funny, but whenever I talk to deep thinkers about the internet, you probe down a little, and they always end up with these appeals to human nature. And it makes me sad.
Well, I mean, there's the sort of Soylent Green response to this, right? Which is to say, the internet is people, because obviously it is. All these networks can do is bring us together. That's all they do. And what that means is that our behavior, the good and the bad, can get amplified within these networks. When we're talking about the problem of homophily, this isn't an internet problem. This is a human problem.
All right. Ethan, thank you very much.
Oh, it was my pleasure, Brooke. Thanks for having me.
Ethan Zuckerman is a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, and he blags at My Heart's in Accra at ethanzuckerman.com.
And now a few of your letters, but first, a correction. Last week in our interview with Cleveland Plain Dealer editor Susan Goldberg, we said that the Associated Press had raised rates for its members. We were wrong about that. In fact, last month, the AP decided to cut its fees for 2009.
A few of you wrote us about last week's interview with David Haydu about the rise and fall of comic books. Julia Linetta says that we failed to draw an historical parallel in that conversation. She writes, I feel that On the Media missed a golden opportunity to compare the comic book hearings of the 50s with the video game hearings of recent times, or even the current media frenzy with regard to the imminent release of Grand Theft Auto 4. Stay tuned, Julia. We do this week.
That interview gave Jocelyn Payne from Anchorage, Alaska, a little insight into why her mom forbade her to read comics. She writes, I was 7 in 1953, and I couldn't grasp what was so bad about Archie and his friends. I grew up to be fascinated by animation and don't miss, at the age of 61, the latest film, but seeing the kinds of comics that sparked the 10-cent plague, I conclude that I might have acted as my mother did. However, I have also come to respect freedom of information and am torn by conflicted concerns.
Many of you responded to Bob's piece about Muslim outrage and the clash of cultures over free speech in Europe. Daniel from Atlanta writes about our use of the words acculturation and assimilation. Quote, did you notice that the word acculturation was said only once in the story? And that came from an interview. Assimilation was used a lot, implying that is the standard immigrant groups should hold to. perhaps a story exploring the difference between the two?
J.T., that's T.E.A., wrote us about the right to offend. Quote, "I believe I have the right to do whatever I wish in contravention with Muslim laws, including blasphemy, defaming the Prophet Muhammad, draw pictures of him, and discuss what I consider the most heinous aspects of Islam. I have the right because I am an American living in the United States. Others can discourage me from doing so, appealing to my sense of responsibility and calling for civil behavior, but no one has the right to force me to obey Islamic law. If I choose to be rude and contemptuous and insulting, then that is my right." Keep your contributions, comments, and corrections coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org or post them at onthemedia.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. Coming up, LSD and Grand Theft Auto.
Dude, this is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
Brooke? That's bad.
Brooke.
Yeah, hold on a second here. I think I just crashed into somebody.
Okay, I'll read it. Grand Theft Auto is, of course, the video game that involves carjacking, drugs, prostitutes, and a virtual city with every last detail.
Ow.
Brooke is murdering her way through the fourth installment, which is expected to pull in $400 million this week after it was released to blindingly glowing reviews. Brooke, you were supposed to actually have done this last night.
Yeah, Bob, but what happened last night is I got stuck in a loop, and I was just wandering the streets of the city, and I got so lonely. The only way you can communicate with people is punching them, and I just punched for 2 hours.
Play. Just play. The ecstatic reviews for the game have been matched by stories warning parents about the extreme violence and the sexual content.
Oh, forget about it. I give up. Turn it off. The Chicago Transit Authority is removing ads for the games from their buses, and pundits have spent the week weighing in on how the game will activate the inner child psychopath. But is there any proof that violent video games breed violent children? Lawrence Kuttner, co-director of the Center for Mental Health and Media at Harvard, conducted a 2-year study funded by the U.S. Department of Justice looking into the relationship. After interviewing 1,200 middle school students and 500 parents, his short answer is no.
Well, when you look at violent youth crime, that's been going down significantly over the past 10 to 15 years. And video game play has gone up and gone up exponentially. So for the general population, there clearly is no relationship there that one does not cause the other. And probably one does not prevent the other either. They're just independent. We did find that those boys and those girls who played almost exclusively M-rated or violent games at age 12, 13, 14 were at greater risk for getting involved in fights and being bullies and things like that. But for boys, what we found is those who did not play video games at all, it's still a small number of them, were also at greater risk. And that's fascinating.
So for certain kids, if you play a lot of violent video games, you could be in trouble. And for other kids, if you don't play any video games, then that could be a marker for trouble. So there's some sort of sweet spot of video game playing that suggests everything's going to be okay?
Well, most kids play some video games, and most 12, 13, 14-year-old boys play some M-rated games. But if you go to the extremes, you seem to be looking at kids who aren't fitting in one way or another. And it was interesting a year ago when you had the shootings of Virginia Tech. Immediately after that, you had the politicians and pundits on the air talking about how this was clearly caused by video games. Well, if you look at the actual report issued by the state of Virginia that investigated this, when Seung-Hui Cho was 9 years old, they say that he didn't like violent video games. his suite mates, the kids that he shared a dorm room with, said that he didn't play video games at all. And that really surprised them because everyone else did. And that was right in line with our findings that the boys who don't play video games at all are left out socially. It's a marker that there's some social problems there.
Did your research suggest that, in fact, violent video games could help some kids resolve issues that might otherwise result in violence?
In the interviews we did, several of the kids said that they would be angry at a particular classmate or other kid at the school and go into a video game, set up an avatar that looks kind of like that kid, and have a fight with them in the game. And at the end, they said, you know, I felt better. And several of them also said that, you know, now I didn't feel a pressure to actually fight the kid. Now, that's a hint. We don't know if that's what's going on. But most kids, when they play a game, feel better at the end of the session. They're more relaxed. If your child is more wound up or more angry at the end of a session, that's a sign that there may be something wrong and something you should pay attention to as a parent. That kid's at greater risk for other issues.
What about the difference among different ages? Surely playing Grand Theft Auto is going to affect a 17-year-old differently than a 12-year-old.
We were studying 12, 13, and 14-year-olds. And when we talked to the boys and you asked them, should you be playing this game? At what age is okay? And they give a predictable answer. You know, they give their age or a year younger. And we knew that. And then we'd say, well, what if you had an 8-year-old brother or sister? Would you let them play the game? Oh, no, 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 no. Well, why not? And they give exactly the same reasons that their own parents give about them, that they can't tell the difference between fantasy and reality. They might act impulsively. But what was really interesting, what they were protective of, and that was cursing. That's what they wanted to shield the younger kids from, because that's what they knew their siblings could actually do. One other thing, we asked the 12, 13, 14-year-old boys, is there any game you should not be allowed to play? And a response we got several times was The Sims. We went, you know, The Sims, that's sort of weird. And they said, well, they kiss.
Ah.
Well, that's something that's scary in the real world to a 12, 13, 14-year-old boy. They had no problem, again, with blowing up buildings or, you know, driving around in fast cars, but being kissed.
Okay, Larry, let's talk about sex. With games like Grand Theft Auto, one of the biggest complaints is violence, but there is sexual content, and people worry about that too. And although the effects are hard to measure, there can't be anything good about 12-year-olds playing a game that involves sex with prostitutes followed by running them over.
The impression that a lot of people have is that it's all about violence and sex. Whereas what we found from the kids is that they were not attracted to the violence and graphic sexual content in the game. As a matter of fact, the games that were purely violent, games like Postal and Manhunt, not a single kid said they liked playing. They found it boring. What they want is complex characters and very interesting, intricate plots. And a lot of those games happen to be M-rated. And many of the kids we talked to who played Grand Theft Auto were not familiar with some of the sexual stuff that gets touted about by the pundits. You know, there are so many ways of playing the game that they didn't run across that.
What about the less dramatic potential negative consequences? I think a lot of parents worry that playing too many video games could make your attention span shorter or maybe even spark ADD or ADHD.
I know of no evidence that shows that playing video games causes ADD. What we do find is that those children who have ADD will often be able to spend much more time concentrating on a video game than they can in a classroom. That is, they can sit still for this more than in a traditional school situation. And what it seems to be is the game is non-judgmental. This is very different from what they interpret as going on in school. And so they can make a mistake, recover, and not feel like they're being blamed for something because the computer or the console is infinitely patient in their eyes.
There is a history of new forms of youth entertainment getting vilified as they go out of the gate. We spoke last week about the hearings regarding the safety of comic books in the 50s. Is this another parallel moment in history?
It seems to be that. in the 1930s, the big concern was gangster films. You were not allowed to show the dynamiting of trains in those films out of fear that teenage boys would blow trains up all over the country. In the 1890s, the big concern, especially for teenage girls, was the new medium of that time, and that was the paperback novel.
How much do you think this fear of video games has been fueled by the media, and how much have the media simply been reflecting the concerns of parents?
I think it works both ways. You know, there has been a lot of concern by very, very well-intended people. The problem has been, are we really focusing on the main causes of violence, or is this just an easy target? And it's such a great political issue if you're running a campaign that it's hard to resist. But the scientific data do not support the dramatic claims that have been raised. It's a much more nuanced issue.
Lawrence Kuttner is co-author of Grand Theft Childhood, The Surprising Truth About Violent Video Games. Thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Looking back on his long life, in 1980, Albert Hofmann described a childhood ramble in the Swiss woods when all at once his surroundings were flooded with birdsong and an uncommonly clear light. He said there were no words to describe the experience, the sense of oneness and blissful security, but it convinced him of, quote, the existence of a miraculous, powerful, unfathomable reality that was hidden from everyday sight. He wrote, I was often troubled in those days, wondering if I would ever, as an adult, be able to communicate these experiences, whether I would have the chance to depict my visions in poetry and paintings. But knowing that I was not cut out to be a poet or artist, I assumed I would have to keep these experiences to myself. Hofmann became a research chemist. In 1938, he first synthesized the compound we now know as LSD. 5 years later, he stumbled upon its peculiar power. It was a day commemorated by many as Bicycle Day. Albert Hofmann died Tuesday at the age of 102. Last year on Bicycle Day, we took a look back at the cultural impact of LSD. So here it is again. Submitted for your consideration, an LSD anniversary, which will begin with a clip from a vintage drugsploitation film.
I first dropped acid when I was 18. I was over at these people's house one night. I was pretty jacked up on marijuana, so I decided to try it, and I dropped it. I don't know what I was waiting for, a flash or a rush or whatever.
What she got was a conversation with the hot dog she'd bought at the snack stand down the street.
And he started telling me that I couldn't eat him. That he had a wife and 7 kids at home to support. And I stood there with his hot dog and asked Terry, do you know this hot dog is talking to me?
Far out. I mean, bummer, dude. That poor woman was probably not among those celebrating Bicycle Day, the anniversary of what is widely considered the first acid trip by Dr. Albert Hofmann on April 19, 1943, in Basel, Switzerland. He could not have foreseen the psychedelic revolution he would inspire that day, 64 years ago, when he ingested 250 micrograms of the compound and then rode his bicycle home from the lab. Martin Lee, co-author of Acid Dreams, The Complete Social History of LSD, says that Hofmann is the antithesis of who and what we now associate with LSD.
Dr. Hofmann, who was working for Sandoz Pharmaceuticals in Switzerland in Basel, was looking for a circulatory stimulant. He was investigating a series of compounds, and he accidentally absorbed a tiny bit of it through his fingertips. That was on April 16th, and he couldn't fathom how such a small amount that could have entered his system could have such profound and powerful effects. So he undertook, on what is now known as Bicycle Day, April 19th, a self-experiment in his laboratory, and he ended up having the first intentional acid trip. But he ended up being so disoriented in his laboratory, he asked to go home. So he rode on a bicycle with the help of his assistant who accompanied him, and said that when he was riding his bicycle, he felt almost as if he was not moving at all, even though he was pedaling at a very fast pace.
Now, through the 40s and the 50s, LSD seemed to have a benign, even actively benevolent reputation.
Well, in the late 40s and early 1950s, LSD was used by scientists to study a potential cure for schizophrenia because it was thought that if you give a normal person LSD, they would become temporarily schizophrenic. And then if they can find an antidote for LSD, maybe that would apply for real schizophrenia. This was the thinking at the time. And also, it provoked interest within the United States Army and the Central Intelligence Agency because of its powerful mind-bending effects, thinking that they could use it for their own purposes.
According to a Time magazine article in 1954, the drug would, quote, help the psychiatrist plan further treatment. Did anyone talk publicly about using it the way that, you know, we talk about Prozac today?
It was used as an aid for psychotherapy, actually fairly widely, and some famous movie stars like Cary Grant really sang its praises. This is by the late 1950s. LSD became all the rage in Hollywood, and some people claim they got more out of one LSD session than they got out of years of psychotherapy. You know, LSD really does have a kind of a Jekyll and Hyde reputation. It could induce extremely frightening and scary experiences or very beatific experiences, and it's very difficult to predict what would happen.
So were the CIA and the Army in the 1950s seeking to exploit the Jekyll part of the drug or the Hyde part?
Well, it depends which one we're saying is the bad one. But the CIA thought they had a drug that would revolutionize the intelligence trade, believe it or not. And what they found, the CIA and the Army, was that if the interrogator threatened to keep the subject in this crazy state forever, they would spill the beans. Now, how reliable the information would be, that's another matter. But this was found to be a very effective torture technique.
In the 60s, the drug culture began to emerge. Can you give us some major LSD cultural milestones?
Certainly music is obvious. You had the whole San Francisco sound, the acid rock from in the Bay Area in the 1960s, groups like the Grateful Dead and the Jefferson Airplane.
One pill makes you larger, and one pill makes you smaller. And the ones that mother gives you don't do anything at all.
But even beyond the Bay Area, think of the Beatles and their album Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band and the wonderful song Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. But beyond music, LSD has had an obvious impact in the arts, in theater. Think of the musical Hair, in poetry, and in this whole computer culture. In the middle 1960s, you know, many of the folks who would become the pioneers.
Are you saying that Steve Jobs was tripping his head off as a kid?
He doesn't deny his involvement with these recreational drugs. And it wasn't just him. There were dozens of people like this. You know, there's no doubt that LSD helped to precipitate the cyber revolution, if you will. And that's quite amazing when you think of the impact of that.
Do you think there's a common denominator for how all these various groups, the Army, the CIA, the counterculture, mental health patients, how they all viewed the drug?
Well, on the surface, it would seem that they had wildly divergent views, and that the CIA and the Army was trying to use LSD as a weapon, whereas people in the counterculture, people like Timothy Leary, were talking about it as a sacrament for a religious experience.
It's as though God has taken you by the hand and led you through the door of sleep, through the door of symbol, through the door of senses, into the heart of his workshop.
The common denominator is that LSD is a drug that enhances possibility. It doesn't necessarily deliver. It doesn't necessarily help a person realize those possibilities. But it's helpful to kind of peel away the sensationalism on both sides of that debate.
Ah, but in the 1970s, Hoffman wrote a book he titled My Problem Child.
That's certainly how he was talking about LSD, because he felt his discovery had become adopted and corrupted by so many people who were using it without a responsible attitude that he felt was important, that it should go along with it. But at his 100th birthday party, he addressed 3,000 people that came to celebrate with him at a conference in Basel, Switzerland. These were young people, you know, had dreadlocks. Some of them had 8 different colored hair, you know. And he was standing on the stage. He put his arms out to embrace the audience and said, when I look at you, he says, I don't think you're my problem child. I think you're my prodigy.
Martin, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Martin A. Lee is the co-author of Acid Dreams, The Complete Social History of LSD. Albert Hoffman died Tuesday at the age of 102.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Jason Isaac and Zach Marsh. We also had help from Nadia Zonis, Sasha Evans, Andy Lancet, and Addie Rolnick. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.